Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Andrew Bacevich, a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University, who previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University, a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy. He served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army and is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, and he has an article at the New York Daily News, The Iraq Reckoning Still to Come, and he also has a memo to the publisher of the New York Times on seeing America's wars whole. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Bacevich.
Well, thanks very much.
And just a couple of days ago, we had the 15th anniversary of the start of the Iraq War. It went largely unnoticed in spite of the fact that over a million people died, something like $6 trillion of U.S. treasure was wasted, and the Middle East is in complete chaos with a proxy war in effect between Iran and Saudi Arabia heating up, and a Secretary of State who is a known hawk ascending to lead U.S. foreign policy along with the president, who is, to put it mildly, expressed a lot of belligerence, particularly towards Iran. So it couldn't be worse. So why is it then that nobody, I mean, is it because it's so terrible nobody wants to talk about it? Is that what's going on?
Well, I might dispute your premise just a little bit. I think it could be worse. I mean, if as rumor suggests, the president fires H.R. McMaster and appoints John Bolton to be the national security advisor, then we will indeed have a right situation that's even worse than today. But nonetheless, the basic point is right. And why does nobody pay attention? I think there's lots of reasons. One of them, I think, is the way that the antics of the president just take up so much of the oxygen, consume so much of the mainstream media's attention that there ends up being a disinclination to focus on stories that I think are much bigger and much more important. And I think the second complementary reason is that even if the New York Times and the Washington Post and other similar entities were banging the drum about how come this war has gone, all these wars have gone on so long to such little profit, American people basically have long since tuned out the wars and wouldn't pay attention anyway.
Well, now, of course, one of the people that I thought in many ways bore a lot of responsibility in the press, and particularly with the New York Times, was Thomas Friedman, in as much as he gave liberals in this country permission to support this boneheaded war. And now, of course, he's writing columns in praise of the young Crown Prince, MBS, who is now visiting Washington.
He wasn't the only war-mongering reporter, but he certainly was a prominent one, and I think that probably he was an influential one. You remember back in the, back through the 1990s and into the present century, in the camp of journalists, Friedman was the one guy who seemed to, claimed at least, to have a grip on the future, who claimed to understand all the forces of modernity and how they were interacting. And therefore, when he turned his attention to Iraq and said, yeah, we need to take down this guy Saddam Hussein, he was speaking with a certain authority. I think the authority was undeserved. He's a showman rather than a truth teller. But the position to which he had ascended made him a fairly influential figure in the discussions of whether or not to invade Iraq.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrew Bacevich, who's a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University. He previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University. He's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy and served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army. And is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. And he has an article at the New York Daily News, The Iraq Reckoning Still to Come, and he also has a memo to the publisher of the New York Times on Seeing America's Wars Whole. Just before we get to talking about the articles in depth, you mentioned things could get worse, and I couldn't agree with you more. The one thing that's extraordinary, though, and terrifying, is that there's a kind of fearful symmetry here between the Kremlin and the White House. Putin has purged all of those that would speak truth to power, particularly Sergei Ivanov, his chief of staff, former KGB general, former diplomat in Scandinavia. He warned against Putin meddling in the U.S. election, thought there'd be terrible blowback. He was purged, and a bunch of hawks, sycophants, and hardliners, particularly from the intelligence services, have taken over, and they're advising Putin now. And the same thing's happening in the White House. Truth tellers, not that they were great heroes like the Secretary of State, but at least he did talk back and at least try to caution President Trump. And if Bolton comes along with Pompeo, then you really have a symmetry. You have sycophants, hawks, and hardliners in both the Kremlin and the White House.
I think that's exactly right. And I'm as troubled by that prospect as you are. And I think what makes it more troubling still, if we recall the argument that was made early in the administration, the argument that, well, the president may have a couple of screws loose, but by golly, there's the adults in the room. And the adults were Mattis at defense, Kelly at the chief of staff of the White House, and McMaster as national security advisor. And I think that in recent months, we've come to appreciate that at least two of those adults, Kelly and McMaster, are themselves deeply flawed individuals, not necessarily the kind of people that should be in the positions that they have. And so we have one quote-unquote adult left, that's Mattis. And indeed, if Bolton would replace McMaster, then Mattis himself is going to be isolated. And that is assuming that Mattis is the adult in the room. I mean, he himself certainly has very hawkish views with regard to Iran.
So the idea that we're all in denial about the tragedy of this war in Iraq, and I remember at the time, talking to there was only a handful of people that even spoke Arabic, like Graham Fuller in the CIA and Bob Baer. And at the time, I was reporting, while the drumbeat of war was going on, that this would be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. Only because, not because I'm any great sort of prescient genius, but because I spoke to the very few Arabic speakers who understood the obvious, which is if you get rid of Saddam, you basically hand over Iraq to Iran. It was kind of a no-brainer. But why then was it missed?
Well, I'd speculate there are two reasons. Among the decision-makers, President George W. Bush, Vice President Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld,
Condoleezza Rice, right.
Also in that group. None of them were regional specialists in any way. I shouldn't say that. Rice, I think, was probably something of a specialist in the old Soviet Union. But certainly none of them had any deep expertise in the Middle East and the Islamic world. And I think collectively they didn't care. That kind of specialized knowledge didn't matter. They were ideologues and they were militarists. I think Bush, Rice, Paul Wolfowitz in particular were ideologues in the sense that they genuinely believed that liberal democracy was destined to prevail everywhere and that given an appropriate push by the United States using its military power, that it was going to prevail first in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. I'm not as sure. I don't believe that Cheney and Rumsfeld drank the neoconservative Kool-Aid in the sense of believing that the spread of democracy was inevitable. But they were thoroughgoing militarists. They believed that by unleashing American military power in the region, we could dominate it. I don't think they really cared a whit whether post-Saddam Iraq embraced liberal values. They wanted to demonstrate the capacity of the United States to achieve a hegemonic position. So whether the perspective was the ideological one, democracy is destined to prevail everywhere, or whether the perspective was the militarist one, that we had this unstoppable military machine, both of those arguments failed in Iraq. Very few of the people who, either insiders or outsiders, who promoted the war are willing to acknowledge that failure. And as I said a couple of minutes ago, the American people have lost interest.
Well, I think, though, the other failure was clearly the failure of the loyal opposition. Again, at the time, I recall, at the time, first of all, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Bob Graham, Democrat of Florida at the time, he had actually asked for a national intelligence estimate, do an NIE, and the White House was so arrogant they hadn't even provided one for justifying this war. So they did the national intelligence estimate, absolutely stacked by the Pentagon and CIA caved. INR at the State Department were and the energy people with the energy department were the only two government departments that stood up and told truth to power. But the amazing thing was that Bob Graham told me that he was trying to tell these other senators, like John Kerry, like Hillary Clinton, like John Edwards, what was really happening. And almost all of the Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee voted against the war, with the exception of Dianne Feinstein and John Edwards. So it's not as if the word wasn't there within the Democratic caucus that this war was a terrible mistake, or would be a terrible mistake, I should say.
Perhaps so. But the reference point for Democratic senators asked to vote thumbs up or thumbs down on this war of choice, the reference point, and it was a false reference point, but the reference point was the Gulf War of 1990-1991, when a considerable number of Democrats voted no and then seemed to pay a political price. But to really put it bluntly, if you voted against the war of 1991, you basically took yourself out of the running for the presidency. Fast forward to 2002, 2003, and we've got Democrats who are keen to position themselves to run for the presidency, and Hillary Clinton and John Kerry are prominent among them. And so they don't vote their consciences. They vote for what they think will advance their own political prospects. I mean, it's contemptible, and they, in a sense, got away with it. Because, I mean, their careers were not, they didn't pay a career price the way they should have. But I think that explains the dynamics, the political dynamics that were operative at the time that the Iraq War was about to begin.
Well, as you point out, though, Andrew Bacevich, in your article at the New York Daily News, The Iraq Reckoning Still to Come, conversely, it was the fact that Donald Trump was the only candidate running for president. That included that whole pantheon of Republicans that he, like a reality star, knocked off the island one by one, along with, of course, Hillary Clinton. Trump did actually tell the truth, even though he lied about himself being against the war at the time, before the war. But nevertheless, on the stump, he made it pretty clear, and you point out that really resonated with it's. In other words, what you're saying is, it's out there in the body politic, in the American zeitgeist, that this was a mistake, and it just takes somebody to step up and say the truth. And of all people, Trump was the one who did it.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I don't believe that Trump's delayed denunciation of the Iraq War and other American military misadventures provides a complete explanation for why he won, but I think it is part of the larger explanation. And so you might think that if you were a member of Congress, a member of the Senate, thinking about making a run for the presidency next time around, or maybe, you know, next time after the next time, you might think that you'd consider becoming a truth teller about our wars. But there's not. I don't follow politics closely enough, but I don't see any serious indication of that lesson resonating with the people who currently hold office.
So let's turn to your, in the last couple of minutes here, Andrew Bacevich, to the other article you've written, which is a memo to the publisher of the New York Times on seeing America's wars whole. What are you trying to impart to the latest heir of the Sulzberger family and now running the paper, which you have to admit, but for the New York Times and the Washington Post, I think there'd be nobody much standing up against Trump, really. He's got his own echo chamber with Fox and right-wing media. At this point, you know...
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go that far, but the point I would make, and God bless the New York Times and the Washington Post for standing up to the president and pointing out his lies and inconsistencies. I mean, in that regard, they're doing their job. But my argument would be that there are other things going on than simply this noxious president. And when I read the Times in particular, I don't read the Post every day, but when I read the Times in particular, I'm just struck by the extent to which Trump's antics and the desire to get rid of him in any way possible just so dominates the coverage in the New York Times, but also in other places, that other important questions simply are being ignored. And you know, this is an old hobby horse of mine, I guess, but I really think that these never-ending wars that date from the immediate aftermath of 9/11 that have consumed vast quantities of treasure, that have seen thousands of Americans killed, tens of thousands of Americans, their lives permanently damaged, hundreds of thousands of people who are not Americans killed, that go on and on and on with no end in sight, no real accountability. It just seems to me that that's a story that screams for greater attention than it is getting from the Times and from other, you know, parts of the mainstream media.
And I suppose to complement that, your argument would be that unless we have a reckoning about the waste of treasure and the... I mean, I recall the Israeli historian Martin Van Creewald said that at the time the Iraq War was the worst strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus invaded Germany in 6 AD. But wouldn't it also mean, until we have this reckoning about Iraq and the Middle East and what we've wrought, we won't have a reckoning about our priorities in terms of budgets? We're spending more on defense today than we are anything else. And,
right.
You know, and, we can't and, fix and, our country until we...
And flooding the world with arms.
Right.
So we have this president who, when he ran, denounced these wars, promised to end them, criticized the cost. He's now in office. He's utterly clueless, I think, about many things. But what he has done, in effect, is to turn the conduct of these wars over to the military. Military doesn't know how to win them, doesn't know how to end them, and so the wars continue. I mean, you know, the president can't even bother to go to Afghanistan, but he has allowed Mattis and the generals to undertake this further escalation, I should say the latest escalation, under the guise of some new strategy when there really is no new strategy. And I find it appalling, and I find it appalling that that they get away with it. And so we need to have that reckoning. We need to come to terms with what we tried to do and what we ended up doing in order to put a stop to this, to come to a more reasoned and more enlightened approach to policy.
Well, Andrew Bacevich, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Bacevich, who's a retired professor of history and international relations at Boston University, who previously taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins University. He's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy and served for 23 years as a commissioned officer in the United States Army, and is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Breach of Trust, Washington Rules, and The Limits of Power. His latest book is America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History, and he has an article at the New York Daily News, The Iraq Reckoning Still to Come, and he also has a memo to the publisher of the New York Times on seeing America's wars whole. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back assessing whether an enraged Donald Trump will fire whoever leaked the briefing paper that warned him, do not congratulate Vladimir Putin.